And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to welcome Denise Kiernan to the program today. Denise is an author, journalist, and producer. She's worked in television, serving as head writer for ABC's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Her writing has appeared in publications like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. She's written several nonfiction works, and her previous title, The Girls of Atomic City, was a New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and NPR bestseller, and has been published in 7 languages. Today we'll be talking about her newest book, The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. How heavily did the legacy of Commodore Vanderbilt weigh on his grandson, George Washington Vanderbilt?
That's really difficult to say, actually. I personally, in my research, didn't find any specific evidence of George being hyper aware of that particular legacy. That may be because he was, you know, one generation away from, you know, his grandfather, and also being the youngest son of William Henry Vanderbilt, the Commodore's son. I feel like probably the majority of the pressure played out for the firstborn, secondborn, thirdborn sons, as well as all of his older sisters. So it's difficult to say. I think if he felt any pressure, it was probably pressure he put upon himself to do something interesting with his life, perhaps.
Weren't there a couple of uncles also named George Washington Vanderbilt?
Yes. I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly who they are without a family tree in front of me. Yes.
I was just wondering if that wanting to stand out, having other people's names, had led to him to make this grand gesture of the Biltmore as a statement of...
You know, that question comes up a lot in a lot of different settings. Why this house? Why so big? Why so grand? I've just sort of come down to believe that this was a man with what appeared to be at the time not unlimited wealth, but it was hard to imagine the limits of the wealth in that day and age, and a profound appreciation for art and architecture and a personal relationship with some of the greatest artists and architects of the day, and just seeing this opportunity to do something very grand. And he was a tremendous patron of the arts and, you know, had worked with his architect, Richard Morris Hunt, before on other family projects, and also seen what that architect was able to do for some of his other family members. And I think he just saw this as a tremendous opportunity to work on a project that involved these areas, art, architecture, forestry, landscaping, that sort of spoke to him. I see it actually as almost kind of like a creative outlet for him. And then I think things just kind of got carried away. There were early sketches of Biltmore that were labeled, you know, the old colonial house, Mr. Vanderbilt's old colonial house or something along those lines. You know, that was markedly smaller than, I mean, under 20,000 square feet, you know, like not even close to 175,000 square feet. One of the more interesting things in research in Hunt's writings and his wife Catherine's writings was Hunt's concern that the house be able to sort of hold its own, that the scale be appropriate to the setting. But when you think that the setting, like the backdrop was, you know, the Blue Ridge Mountains, you can sort of see why, if he was concerned about scale and the house being able to sort of hold its own against that, you can kind of see how they ended up getting a little carried away with things.
And why did he choose that location?
In 1888, he had gone down to Asheville with his mother. It was not unusual for folks to visit Asheville from the north, northeast. It was not unusual for families to come up to Asheville from the south, especially places like Charleston, where it got so hot in the summer. Asheville had become a destination for sanitariums. This is where people went if you were suffering from symptoms related to malaria or tuberculosis. The mountain air in and around Western North Carolina was believed to be curative. So a lot of very well-known doctors set up shop in and around Asheville, and patients would come, and the term breathing porches evolved. People would actually go there to be treated by these doctors and actually sit on these grand porches and breathe, because the air was supposed to be so good for you. So George was down in Asheville with his mom in 1888, and while she was being treated by a doctor named Samuel Westray Battle, he was out on his horse riding and taking in the views and enjoying the sights, and he was really kind of taken by what he saw there, the long-range vistas, the setting, the temperature. He liked it, and he thought, this is probably a good spot for a country house. It wasn't his first. He had a house in Bar Harbor at that point already. The family house was on Fifth Avenue, but he decided he was going to go much further afield for what he was going to undertake.
And seeing photographs of the time of how much of the surrounding forest had been clear-cut and how it was just bald and stumps everywhere, to have that vision that one man could initiate reforesting the area is incredible.
And you could see, well, some of those vistas are so long range, you could see to a certain extent, you knew beyond there was tremendous biodiversity from a forestry standpoint. This is one of the reasons he wanted Olmsted, Frederick Law Olmsted, to come down early in the process. He wanted Olmsted's opinion after he had only purchased roughly about 2,000 acres when he brought Olmsted down and took him out to the site that had really kind of captivated him and said, what do you think? You know, Olmsted in his letters, he was like, oh my God, it was, things were a mess. The forests were in such horrible shape because back then no one thought that we'd ever run out of trees. It was this huge country and there were trees everywhere. So everybody just, kept chopping willy-nilly. And Olmsted knew also, though, because he had done such extensive traveling in that part of the country and actually written about it years earlier, he knew that beyond the decimation he could see, he knew there were quality forests and interesting hardwoods and a variety of specimens. So I think it was that confidence that Olmsted had in what the potential was that, allowed the guys to move forward.
Now, this book is more about the family, George Washington Vanderbilt and his eventual wife, Edith Dresser.
Yeah, I actually start the book with Edith.
Someone who's going to marry into the Vanderbilt family can't come from nothing. So what was the pedigree that Edith brought to the family?
Edith, her maiden name was Edith Stuyvesant Dresser. Her ancestors were the Stuyvesant family and also the Fish family as well. She was a direct descendant of the last Dutch governor of New York, Peter Stuyvesant. So that was one of the oldest, most established New York lines around. The Fish family was also very well established in New York society. That said, she did not have anywhere near the financial resources that George had. But her grandmother especially knew all the right families. They had a very well-established place in society. So even though her financial holdings could not compare to George's, her family line was substantial and very impressive. And her grandmother especially was a very well-respected individual in New York society.
And her grandmother was such a large part of her and her sister's lives because they had been touched by tragedy at an early age.
Well, I don't want to give away too many. I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but yes, I agree with you. Her grandmother was a very, very strong influence, I think, on her and her sisters, for sure.
And it's just amazing the amount of tragedy that befalls both sides of the family
over
the years.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's hard to show how resilient someone is unless you show how much tragedy and loss they've had to endure. And showing Edith's resilience as the decades go on. I mean, this wasn't just like she had a tough time when she was a kid and that was it. I mean, there were a lot more challenges coming in her adult life as well. And I go into those in the book, but it's one of those things where, it doesn't matter what your family name is. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how big your house is. No one is immune to grief. No one is immune to loss. No one is immune to pain. And it's interesting to get a look at people's character when they're faced with these situations. And that was something I definitely wanted to do in the book.
Now, Edith not only married into the Vanderbilt family, but she married into the house.
Yes, yes, she did. If she hadn't, it was looking like it was going to be the biggest bachelor pad ever on the face of the earth. Yeah. So she gets married and then she's mistress of the largest house in the United States of America. One of the fun things about the book was looking into how the media covered her and covered their engagement. And they were constantly pitting, like, you know, one engaged socialite against another engaged socialite, sort of like, you know, who, quote unquote, won. It was horrible to see how they compared these women who were marrying some of these wealthy bachelors. And a lot of discussion came up about the fact that Edith, you know, she and George had the house at 640 Fifth Avenue, which was not a shabby place by any stretch of the imagination, but also that she would be mistress of Biltmore House, you know, the largest house in America. And that in and of itself, I think, would probably be something that would be quite an undertaking for any new bride. But the fact that it was in Southern Appalachia was just a whole other level of, it was a big fish out of water experience, I think.
And with that being her family, the fish family.
Yeah, the fifth, that's right, the literal fish, the fish descendant out of water, that's right.
Seen like the gossip column of Charlie Knickerbocker.
Yes.
We know that trolls and Twitter insult culture.
Body shaming was alive and well in the 1890s and early 1900s. Oh, yeah. I was amazed the way these folks were just stalked by the press. And a lot of it was related to their appearance. There's one article I quote in the book where he's talking about who was showing their shoulders at the opera and who had unattractive shoulders. And the press really piled on when she got engaged to George. They were getting covered not just throughout the United States. They were getting covered in other parts of the world as well. But yeah, it was fairly relentless.
And she was striking because she was so tall for the time.
She was very tall. She was very tall, yes. Certainly taller than George. All of her sisters were pretty tall. Her brother, Daniel, was very, very tall. I think she's very attractive. But if she was not sort of classically beautiful, she had this tremendous, you know, carriage and was, you know, just very tall and, you know, carried herself very well. And definitely she was the kind of person, like, if she walked into a room, people noticed.
And George was handsome in his way as well.
Yes. Yeah. Dark, dark eyes, dark mustache.
I thought he's cute.
Yeah. He's a nice looking guy. His niece Consuelo thought he looked like a Spaniard. I can sort of see that. But yeah, definitely a fit guy. Very nice eyes. I think George had very nice eyes.
There were reports that Edith was not a big fan of the house.
There were some reports in some of the New York newspapers of that. I don't believe that, actually. To me, that doesn't jibe with how invested she became with the community there. She could have spent a lot less time interacting with the folks of Biltmore Village, the folks of the, you know, the village outside the gates of the estate. She did not have to invest in schools and charitable events. And so there were reports of that. Who knows why they were written? Could have been taken out of context. It could have been gossip fodder, but it was, I don't think that it matched up with the way that she sort of engaged with the folks there.
Because they did seem to honor that noblesse oblige.
They were extremely charitable. There was a level of intimacy to her charity that I found quite moving. She wasn't the kind of person who would just kind of sit behind the wrought iron gates and write checks for people. She was the kind of person who would hop on a horse and take blankets or soup or something to an employee who wasn't feeling well, or look in on the pregnant wife of an employee. She was involved. There were a lot of people of the upper class back then who donated money, but she also really gave of her time. And I think that was something that kind of set her apart in a way.
Now, from groundbreaking to the first Christmas event George had for his family, how long did it take?
That was roughly about 6 years. He went down there and started buying in 1888. They had the house plan set around 1889 and began in earnest. And then they had the Christmas 1895. He had friends and family come down. Although people had been visiting while they were building as well. There was so much curiosity.
Now, earlier you had mentioned Richard Morris Hunt, the architect, and Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscaping genius. These were men at the top of their professions,
oh, yeah,
but also very late in their careers, and it seems like this project took a lot out of them physically as well.
It did. They were running around a lot at the time. They were both intimately involved with the Chicago World Fair of 1893. That was huge responsibility for both of them. So they were spending a lot of time in Chicago. They had other clients to attend to, so they traveled a lot. And so they had people who kind of operated on the ground for them that they would give instructions to when they could not be in Asheville. And of course, they went back to Asheville a lot. It's really the last major great work for both men. There were a lot of other things going on, but this was kind of a big, big hurrah for the two of them. And it did take an awful lot out of them.
Now, where did George get the name Biltmore?
So there's a town in Holland, what was then called Holland, called Bilt. That is believed to be where his family name, Van der Bilt, came from. So he decided to name the estate Bilton. And that was the first name of the estate. It was Bilton. And they were contacted by the postmaster from Bolton, North Carolina, who said, no, Bilton's a little too close to Bolton. I would really appreciate it if you would change the name. So the suffix more was drawn from the concept of an English more. That geographical feature. So that's where Biltmore came from. And I think it's very interesting today that, you know, if you're in California or Florida or Arizona or New York, I mean, the name Biltmore is everywhere. And, you know, outside of the southeast part of the country, most people have no idea where the name came from.
It even has a continuing influence with that putting more at the end of Bilt, because there's that huge home in southern Missouri, Pensmore, which is like 72,000 square feet.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a big controversy right now. It was built with like 2-foot thick concrete walls in order to be able to withstand an F5 tornado.
And when was it built?
In the past 3 or 4 years.
In the past 3 or 4 years?
And they were supposed to have these special fibers woven into the concrete that reinforced it, and they did not put enough of those in. So the man behind the project now has demand they tear it down and pour it again. And it's like a $63 million lawsuit, and it's 72,000 square feet. It's like the 10th biggest home in America.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
But he called it Pensmore.
Pensmore. Where did the Pens part come from?
I'm not sure. It's not his last name.
Uh-huh. And so are they going to do it?
The lawsuit is underway.
Wow. Interesting. Whose home is it?
I can't remember the gentleman's name. I think it's maybe a Hunt, maybe.
Okay.
Even early on, a local farmer complained that everything in the area would be called Biltmore this and Biltmore that because the economic influence. And he really had no idea how true that would become.
Yeah. There was a gentleman who wrote into the newspaper. He signed his letter anti-Biltmore. He wrote into the newspaper shortly after George announced the name, that the estate was going to be named Biltmore, that the train station was now going to be called Biltmore, that the area outside the estate, main estate entrance, was going to be that little crossroads, was no longer going to be called Best. It was going to be called Biltmore. He was sort of saying, you can call your estate whatever you want, but why do you have to rename this and rename that? Pretty soon we're going to have, you know, Biltmore Road and Biltmore this and Biltmore that. And when I did my talk in Asheville, North Carolina, I actually read that letter to the crowd, because when you go to Asheville, it is everywhere. There's Biltmore Avenue. There's, you know, Biltmore Oil. There's Biltmore Preschool. There's He had no idea in the late 19th century how true his words were going to prove to be, not by any stretch of the imagination.
With such a big undertaking, the tax burden is going to be huge on a property like this. The staffing is going to be huge. Utilities and upkeep is going to be huge. What kind of business ventures did they undertake in order to try to make it more of a self-sustaining property?
He did have this vision of sort of a working estate that could support itself. They had at different times over the years, they had poultry operations, they had a dairy, they had a piggery, they had a very large herb farm, they lumbered. They dabbled in a lot of different things to varying degrees of success.
Now, the two main foresters of the property were Gifford Pinchot and Carl Schenck. How did they differ in their approach to preserving and expanding the forest?
Gifford Pinchot was the first forester brought on. He was American. Carl Schenck was German. Both of them were concerned with being able to rejuvenate these decimated forests, knowing full well that George was probably going to want to lumber as well as a means of making some money. Pinchot was there a much shorter amount of time than Schenck was. He actually created what was called the Biltmore Working Plan early on and presented that plan actually at, there was a Biltmore exhibit at the 1893 Chicago World Fair. Pinchot's plan was presented there, and this resulted in his getting a lot of consulting offers from around the country. So they needed someone to come in again on a more permanent basis, and that's how Schenck ended up coming to Biltmore. And when Schenck got there, he was more familiar with what was referred to at the time as scientific forestry, which was, very simply put, the concept that you could focus on the health of the forest, rejuvenate the forest, grow and strengthen the health of the forest while still selectively lumbering. Schenck would have put more emphasis on the lumbering than Pinchot did. Pinchot was still involved to a certain extent at Biltmore, even after he sort of left his full-time post there. The importance that Schenck placed at the Biltmore School of Forestry, which he created with George's help, was probably something that Pinchot would not have focused on quite to the extent that Schenck did. I mean, what's amazing to me is that's the first school of forestry in the United States of America. That was at Biltmore House.
For a private property, essentially.
Yeah. There was no other school that existed before them. So when they talk about that part of the state being the cradle of forestry, I mean, it's the cradle of forestry.
How many trees did they plant in order to rejuvenate all the cut forests that were around?
Oh, my God, I have no idea. The plantings were in various successions at various times and... I don't have that number.
I visited last year, and maybe like 3 million trees over 10 years or something like that.
Well, there were plant numbers given that Chauncey Beadle, who was one of the predominant groundskeepers there, so that number might include plants and shrubs, and I don't know, or maybe it is a number of trees, but I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Because walking through, you could never imagine that that area had been clear-cut.
No, but you also, walking through, you don't get to see, you know, at the height of his holdings, it was between 120 and 125,000 acres. So what you see walking through is so limited.
But even in the vista off mm-hmm.
It looks beautiful. Yeah, it looks very healthy. I mean, it's still, you know, lumbering is still ongoing there and, you know, remains an issue. But because so much of those forests were put into a national forest, therefore in a public trust, there is a larger conversation, I think, that involves everyone to whom the forest mattered regarding some of those policies going forward and what people are allowed to lumber. Those debates are kind of ongoing.
Now, to someone the surrounding land held a great deal of importance to was a Mr. Charles Collins.
Yes. Charles was one of those folks, he didn't feel like selling to George. You know, when George decided to start building, you know, digging into the area, he bought various parcels here and there and did so under using an agent initially, not always purchasing under his own name. And, you know, a lot of people sold. That's how he accumulated so much land. But yeah, Charles Collins eventually did sell, but it was years. They were well past finishing the main construction before Collins decided to sell. And he just, you know, he didn't mind having George as a neighbor.
But he did not get the Vanderbilt bonus.
What's the Vanderbilt bonus?
Well, whenever a rich person tries to buy up multiple properties, once someone knows it's a rich person, they want to charge him a little bit extra.
Sure.
And so he eventually...
Sure, yes. He probably would have gotten more had he sold... He would have gotten more if he'd sold earlier on, yeah.
You talked about the press and their coverage of the impending nuptials of George and Edith, but what did it compare like to the birth of Cornelia, their daughter?
Cornelia's birth got quite a bit of coverage as well because it happened in Asheville, perhaps that tempered it a bit. But I mean, her birth was in the New York Times and it was really embraced by the community. And in a lot of ways, I think they're having Cornelia in Asheville as opposed to in New York, where they very well could have, I really think sort of cemented their relationship with the area in a certain way. But people were quite taken with the idea that the big, beautiful house was now going to have a little girl running around in it. But one fellow even went so far as to write a poem to the baby that he sent into the newspaper that was published. And it definitely captivated the community for sure.
It's pretty easy to understand the decline in interest in poetry in America after that poem.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It was charming in its intent, but not necessarily exceptionally executed. But yes,
it aspired to doggerel, but didn't make it.
Yeah.
Later on, the financial burdens of keeping up the estate are so much that they actually save money by going away and living elsewhere for long periods of time.
Yeah, it wasn't terribly unusual for the wealthy in America to spend significant amounts of time overseas. And it was more affordable because even if it's a flat in Paris, it's still a flat in Paris and not a 175,000 square foot house. Staffing needs are much different. They also liked to travel. It was on a certain level what was expected of that class to travel a lot. You know, they had family in different places. They had friends in different places. I'd love to say I need to save some money. I'm going to go to Paris. that sounds nice to me.
I guess if you lived in the Bay Area, you could probably say that.
Yeah, maybe I could say that's right. That's right.
Now, one of the people I was most fascinated with in the story was one of George's closest friends, Paul Lester Ford.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard of him as a novelist and as a historian,
yeah.
And it's amazing what he accomplished in those fields.
Oh, my God. He's one of my favorite people in the book. I mean, you want to talk about somebody who endured hardships growing up, physical ailments growing up. His growth was severely thwarted by childhood illness. He spent most of his childhood in his father Gordon's just remarkable library, considered one of the greatest in the country. And so Paul just dug into books and writing and then began publishing his own works and was extremely, extremely successful. So learning more about Paul Lester Ford was definitely one of the treats of working on this book, for sure.
People visit Biltmore by the thousands now, but it served our country more than just as an attraction and see how the rich used to live back in the robber baron in the Gilded Age days. They joined the war effort in World War II.
Yes, the house served a very particular purpose during World War II, a very valuable and particular service during World War II. That's all I'm going to say.
You've written a financial advice book for the self-employed and freelancers.
Absolutely.
What kind of advice would you have given to George Washington Vanderbilt back in the day to help his finances a little bit?
Well, what's interesting is when he was a kid, he used to keep track of every penny he spent. And somewhere along the line, I think he got out of that habit. And this does happen with freelancers too. I think when people start out, when my husband and I wrote the book was called The Money Book for Freelancers, Part-Timers, and the Self-Employed, and we interviewed a lot of different kinds of independent contractors, hairdressers, plumbers, writers, you know, things of that nature. And a lot of people were better off at tracking their money when they didn't have that much. That's when they were very good at tracking what was coming in and what was going out. But as they became more successful, they didn't do that as much. And one of the arguments that we made is like, you always need to know where you're. It's your way of saying, I value this money. I need to know where it's going. So I think George should have kept that little habit he had when he was a kid of where every penny went. I think he probably should have kept up with that a little more when he got older.
Now, was there at any point during the research for the book, you're looking at this huge property and all these people's lives over the years, do you felt like maybe you'd gotten in over your head, maybe like George had maybe gotten over his head with the Biltmore?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm pretty good about assessing ideas before I decide to pull the trigger and work on something. Like before I go to my agent or an editor and say, this is what I want to work on next, I have been thinking about that, the proposed project, for a very long time. Books always seem, well, they always can be bigger. They always sort of take on a life of their own. You can outline, and I do extensively, but you can never kind of tell exactly where they're going to go or where they're going to land or how they're going to change direction, because things just do. You got to kind of let the story take you where it needs to go. Compared to The Girls of Atomic City, which was my last book, which was kind of a very focused timeline, this one, you know, spans decades. So it was much larger in that respect. But that's why staying kind of focused on the house and the people who lived in it helped kind of tame that unruliness.
Did you have access to the archives at the estate?
Actually, they didn't have what I wanted. When you do books like this, if I write you a letter and you and I both die, my thoughts and feelings are in your archives. So what happens is it becomes this tremendous paper chase. So I had like the New York Public Library Manuscripts and Archives Division had three or four huge holdings that were extremely valuable to me. In fact, if I had not known about them, I would not have done this book. Brown Library, Edith's sister married into the Brown family, as in, you know, Brown Providence, Brown University. So her sister's papers had a bunch of Edith's letters, her nephew's papers, her brother-in-law's papers, and a lot of those shone a light on what Edith's childhood was like. And what I wanted to do was, you know, show Edith as a person before she became just, you know, the wife of George Vanderbilt. So the Hay Library at Brown University was incredibly important to me. The Yale Beinecke Library had some great Paul Lester Ford holdings. The Wellcome Library in the United Kingdom had some great letters. I mean, so there was stuff from all over the place, but that's my favorite. I love doing that sort of stuff. I kind of get sad that now people are just turning over their hard drives and that's what you're going to go through in the future and that's where we're headed. And I understand that, you know, things change and everything, but I really like holding letters in my hand and seeing postmarks and examining stationery and all that stuff.
Think of researchers in the future having to learn what emoticons and all the internet abbreviations are for people's emails in the future.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait to see what they think of it.
What would be the largest house you would be comfortable living in?
Oh, that's, you know, that's a very good question. I don't know. I can't see being, unless you had the kind of lifestyle where you were constantly having a ton of visitors, I can't see myself living in a house much more than like maybe 3,000 or 4,000 square feet. I like cozy houses.
I've heard 3,000 is about the max a family can take care of themselves.
Yeah. Even that's a stretch at times.
And is there another topic that's got your attention right now?
Oh, yeah. I'm working on my next book. I don't talk about projects when I'm early on, but it'll be another narrative nonfiction book. Yeah, I try to move into the next thing as quickly as possible.
What's your favorite time of year to visit the Biltmore Estate?
Oh, I go year-round. I love going year-round because I love the garden so much, and the different times of year really allow you to see different things in bloom. The landscaping looks different. The trees look different. The flowers are all different. So one of the things I like about the fact that the grounds are so beautiful is that going back at different times of year is so much fun.
Well, Denise, I want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us today. It's
been
a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Denise Kiernan is the author of The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home, which is published by Touchstone, Simon & Schuster. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.